I remember when I came to school, it's like everybody that I met was either in the Peace Corps or was in JET or something similar, you know, in different kinds of programs. But we were all like a few years out of undergraduate with a few years of experience, and that experience was in another country. So it just was like, it just felt like everyone that I met, like we just kind of understood each other on some level, even though we had different experiences, different routes, but there was something that we shared, and it just really gelled.
This is a production of JetWit.com. Special thanks to USJet AA and Claire for their support.
Hello and welcome to the Jetosphere podcast, the podcast about things related to the JET alumni community, broadly defined. I'm Stephen Horowitz. I was an ALT in Aichi-ken, Kariyoshi from 1992 to 1994. And today we're very honored to have as our guests two people who are both not only alumni of the JET program, but also alumni of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, frequently represented by the acronym MIIS, which I think is often shortened in talking to just MIS. Is that right, guys? Just MIS.
100%.
Okay, that's how students refer to it. They call it just MIS. Okay. So we've established that. So the two people here we have are Professor Scott Polizzi, and we also have Rebecca Gutentag. So welcome, Scott and Rebecca.
Hello there.
Thanks for having us.
Before I start asking you questions, I first just want to share a word from the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, also known as MIS. Okay. Would you like to use your Japanese professionally? A master's degree from the Middlebury Institute of International Studies can help turn your experience into a rewarding career. Work in video game localization or as a State Department interpreter, a study abroad advisor, or an international development specialist. Whether you study online or in person, you'll learn from some of the world's leading experts in international affairs and language services. And JET alumni are guaranteed 25% tuition scholarships. To learn more, go to go.miis.edu/JET. Okay, and now on with our interview. And that information from MIS is extremely relevant to what we'll be discussing today, of course, because MIS is actually, as I understand it, and as I've often seen, a well-traveled post-JET career path. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit more about our guests. Scott Polizzi was a JET in Sagaken in Hizen-shi or Hizen-cho?
Hizen-cho.
Hizen-cho, okay. From 1992 to 1994, which is the same year as I was there. So we might have met at orientation in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Scott has an MA from MIS in Public Administration and Policy, and he's also currently an associate professor at MIS. He is an accomplished international development professional and has worked with United Nations agencies, national governments, non-governmental organizations, foundations, and businesses in dozens of countries to improve well-being. And this includes serving as a team leader at UNESCO in Paris, a program director for the government of Botswana, a policy evaluator in Indonesia, and a junior high school English teacher in Japan, which of course was his time on the JET program. In addition to teaching at the Middlebury Institute, he is currently serving as a technical advisor to international and local civil society organizations on strategy and program development. And about Rebecca Gutentag, or Becca, she has an MA from MIS in, I'm still getting comfortable saying MIS. She has an MA from MIS in Translation and Localization Management. She's a graduate of Kenyon College with a liberal arts BA and a focus in sociology and East Asian studies. And she's currently a localization producer for Riot Games, which is a big video game maker. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Hopefully getting bigger by the day. So I still have a paycheck.
All right. Okay. So let me start by asking you guys what you did JET and then you went to MIS. I guess I should ask you first, how'd you end up on JET? Scott, you want to start?
Sure. I was, I actually did a year abroad, study abroad program in my junior year of college in Tokyo. And I felt like it was a great experience, but I really wanted to understand Japan a little bit more. And the opportunity to especially live outside of the city in a rural area just gave me a different perspective on on the country and on society. And it just was quite interesting for me. So I just felt like I had unfinished business and I really wanted to go back. So
how did you even, I mean, when we applied for JET, that was pre-internet. How did you even learn about the JET program? Do you remember?
That's a good question. That is a really good question. I don't really know. Yeah, it was totally pre-internet. Yeah, I can't remember.
Because I distinctly remember, I was like, I think I'm just going to go abroad. I don't know what to do after college. And so I went into our career services office at my university. And I saw, among other things, I saw this thing for something called the JET program. And there was a little video I could watch. So I put the video into the VHS machine. They had right there. And I watched it. And I was like, I still don't get it. This video is... It sort of explains it, but I was like, I'm going to apply, just see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. That might have been it. It might have been at either the college, or I might have heard about it when I was in Tokyo. Maybe people, I don't know how old the program was. But that might have been, but I can't remember that moment, but yeah. I remember going to the consulate in New York at some point. I guess that was for the interview, but that's interesting. That's a long time ago.
A long time ago. Good question. It's 1992. That's 30 years ago, right? We've had more time after JET than we had before JET at this point.
True.
Anyway, sorry, Becca, we're freaking you out, aren't we? Becca, how did you end up on JET?
I was very similar to Scott. I, had an interest in Japan growing up. I was originally born in Japan through my parents working there and came to the US when I was really young. So I had all these stories of Japan and knew I wanted to go back. Technical difficulties.
my earbud came out.
Oh my God, it traveled.
it went down and rolled across the floor. I realized they stay in really well, but when I smile, they slide out.
They slide out.
Me laugh. When I laugh, they tend to like work their way out.
I'll be much more serious now. I always had that interest in Japan growing up. Got the opportunity to study Japanese in college and, like Scott, studied abroad my junior year. Directly in Tokyo at Waseda University. So I saw you had the Waseda email.
Did you do the international program there?
I did. It was the Japan Study Program in partnership with Earlham, I believe. So Kenyon was a partner school with them. I studied abroad and I had a pretty good year in Tokyo. It was a big city, a lot for me. And I came back and I remember thinking, I'll look for something here in the States. And my mother was actually the one who was like, there's this JET program thing. I know people who've done it. I think you'd really like it.
So you learned about it from your mom.
Yeah, I did. And to be fair, there was also, we had former students who presented to our senior Japanese class as well. So there were just all these people kind of piling up saying, there's this thing called the JET program. You should try it. And I said, all right, I'll do it for, I'll apply and see if I get in. I got in and I was like, I'll see if I do, I'll try the year and that'll be it. And then I was there for four. So definitely hooked me in.
You said your parents lived and worked in Japan?
Yeah. So my parents were both military doctors and were stationed in Okinawa. So my brother and I were both born there. I remember when I interviewed for JET, they said, as part of the application, it was like, where do you want to go? And I was like, I'll go to Okinawa. That'll be great. And I think they looked at that and said, all right, Kyushu's close enough.
There's probably a lot of requests for Okinawa, I would imagine.
Probably. Not as many for Oita.
And then how did you decide to go to MIS, to Monterey after JET?
Yeah, so I can jump on this one, which is to kind of tie a few things together that will probably come up later in the interview. Growing up, I had an interest in video games. And I remember in 2008-ish, I read this blog post by a woman who worked at Capcom in localization. And she mentioned localization as a thing. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And then completely forgot about it. Cut to me being on my fourth year of JET, not knowing what I was going to do. I knew I didn't want to do a fifth year acting as an English teacher, but I was exploring options as to whether to work in Japan, whether to go back home. And I had a couple friends who had left the JET program ahead of me. who had joined the Middlebury Institute, one for a path towards education and one in a path towards localization. And it was like that triggered that memory in me from a decade earlier. I was like, oh, there's a degree program for that? Well, it might be interesting to pursue it. And that's how I got there.
I wish I had talked to you, or I wish I had met Scott at orientation, because I was in the same boat. I didn't know what to do. So I went to law school. That was not the right decision for me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I made that mistake. Anyway, so if I knew about the Monterey thing, I might have done that. Plus, Monterey seems like a pretty cool place to be.
I was going to say, I can plug the Middlebury Institute a little bit. One of the saving graces as well was that they had applications, because I know I was getting towards the summer at the end of my fourth year. And I was like, oh, I'm kind of losing my time window to figure things out. And I saw, again, Miss got on my radar, and I thought, oh, well, the new school year starting in August. There's no way they're accepting applications. I think they accept applications through the end of June. So that was for people on JET who are trying to figure out what they want to do, just know that they have applications open for a lot longer than you'd think.
Oh, that's a really helpful tip.
Yeah. Super helpful.
And I think they really do appreciate, they really love JET applicants too. So.
Oh yeah.
And Scott, how did you find yourself in Monterey?
Mm-hmm. This I do remember. There was a kind of a catalog of some sort of schools that offered international policy, public affairs, master's programs. I had a physical catalog.
Right, I was 1994, we had catalogs still.
Yeah, and I just kind of scrolled through, and then I wrote to the schools that I thought were most interesting, and Miss wrote back, and I remember getting the kind of brochures and portfolio documentation. I looked through it, and there was no internet at that time, so I just kind of had like 8 or 10 different schools to choose from that I sent away from this catalog. And I think it was probably from like the World Affairs Council or something like that that had this catalog, or that's where I learned about it. And so I studied international policy, basically, so the different field from Becca. But I guess these catalogs were like kind of the way to find out about things back then. And I looked at Miss, and then I applied, got in, and then I visited the school before I actually attended and met with the dean at the time. And he told me, I just told him what I was interested in. And he said, you're the kind of person that should be here. And that just really stuck with me. And I remember when I came to school, it's like everybody that I met was either in the Peace Corps or was in JET or something similar, in different kinds of programs. But we were all like a few years out of undergraduate with a few years of experience. And that experience was in another country. So it just was like, it just felt like everyone that I met, like we just kind of understood each other on some level, even though we had different experiences, different routes, but there was something that we shared, and it just really gelled. So, I'm working there now. So obviously I like the environment. And what I find really interesting is the students that I have now, I can see myself in them in some way, I understand exactly what they're about. That's maybe too ambitious, but I just feel like there's a connection. I just see them as a cohort very similar to the cohort that I was in back in 95 when I went, So it's kind of, that is giving me a source of energy just to know there's a continuity, and there are people out there who just want to engage with the world in a certain way. It gives a space for people who just have questions about the world and really want to make a contribution, and it allows us to do that. So that's why I like the school. And there just seems to be a through line between the JET experience too, because the JET experience was trying to create connections with people and trying to create exchanges. And it put me in a place where I never would be otherwise, and it allowed me to connect with students that I never would have had the opportunity to do without the JET program.
And what were some of the courses that you guys took at MIS? What were some of your experiences there that you remember that were formative? Or impactful.
One of the classes I took was about human capacity development, about how humans in their situations can fulfill their ultimate capacity. So that kind of gave me the North Star, I guess, for my career. Like if everything in my career has been oriented towards the fact that I should try to remove barriers that prohibit people from achieving their full potential, So be it education or poverty or health or whatever barrier that is, that's what I should work towards addressing. So I've spent a lot of time in Africa and Caribbean and South Asia on teaching public health practices to teachers and learners. So, you know, try to, you know, in the response to kind of pandemics like HIV, those are the things that kind of got me on path to making the best contribution I can. And what I felt was really interesting is that my job as a JET teacher, as I understood it, was to, you know, the concept was that people were teaching very didactic ways, right? So the JET program was to bring in people to kind of energize the curriculum and make it more fun and engaging. And it turned out that particular skill that I developed at the JET program was really, really useful for teaching life skills and things of that nature. So that basically became the thing that I did for 20 years. I kind of traveled around and worked with teachers organizations and said, you know, how can we be more animated in our teaching and make it more engaging for learners? And I did a lot of teacher training, and it brought me to many, like 40 different countries to do that. So I really credit the JET program for giving me that spark.
That's a great example, because a lot of people go on JET and they say, how do I translate this into what skills can I say I have on a resume? You know, and people say you have great soft skills, but you still don't know what to write down on a resume or as an example. And you just gave a really terrific example. I should clarify, so you guys did different programs, right? You did a master's, Scott, you did a master's in?
Yeah, public policy and administration.
Okay. Yeah. And Rebecca, you did a master's in
translation and localization management.
Okay.
So,
and do the classes overlap at all? Or do the programs overlap?
I was going to say, the kind of interesting thing about MIS is that, you know, the one major, I guess, kind of cornerstone of it is that language, you know, the commitment to language and how it interacts with these various graduate programs. So while for me, the majority of my classwork was in translation, localization management courses, our language courses were integrated with people from all other disciplines. So when you apply to the Middlebury Institute, there are a couple different, based on your degree program, the extent to which you're using your language may differ. You know, obviously in a translation program, they expect people to have a very high level of their B language. But even beyond that, it assumes that everyone has some language background. So it kind of brings all of the different disciplines together in these language courses, in some of the, I guess, more generic courses that you can take cross-departmentally. So I got a lot of benefit out of not only working with the people in my translation localization management program, but meeting other people who were in something like IPD, International Policy Development, but in my same Japanese class.
Yeah, were there other opportunities for interaction with people from the different programs? And Becca, you finished your program in the middle of the pandemic, right?
I did indeed.
So part of it was entirely online. But they also offer,
yeah.
I mean, MIS also offers entirely online versions of the program, right?
Right. So I think they've been expanding it more depending on the different programs. But for the translation and localization management program, we definitely were kind of that test group of that my last semester. But even before that, they had been ideating ways to be able to offer this course to people who couldn't come in to Monterey directly. I must admit, I don't know how much they've expanded that in the past few years, but I know that we definitely were able to, I guess, move into that virtual space pretty well. And thankfully, I know everyone's back on campus, or those who want to be, for the in-person class experience.
And Scott, what do you remember about interaction with people from the other programs at MIS?
I think Becca's right. It's the language that really brings us all together. The fact that we, you know, interact with the world in different way through languages and learning, and it's language as it's tied to culture, I think is also part of it. You know, it's not just a mechanical aspect of speaking. It's also kind of appreciating, you know, why the language is structured in a certain way and what it means and what it conveys. And for me, the comparing Japanese to English is just such a, you know, like there's so many contrasts there and so many different ways of doing things. And I feel like the big lesson there is just to appreciate difference, you know, not to be judgmental, but just realize like, yes, you don't have to have, you can have the negation at the very last syllable of a sentence, right? Like that to me is a very, you know, different way of thinking. And it's just really interesting. And I think that was the biggest takeaway from JET. And then it kind of carried through to school is that, you know, when I went to my master's, just to appreciate difference is that that's not to be judgmental. I guess that's the big thing.
And actually, if I can follow up on that, I found it was so interesting because in Japan, sort of like you mentioned, we were the representative of our culture, bringing, you know, English to the students and also learning from them what they could teach us about Japan. And so going back to MIS, where, you know, it's not just a program for Japanese, you know, people who taught in Japan or worked in Japan, it's for people who worked in all sorts of education programs around the world, in all sorts of volunteer programs. So it was like the reverse suddenly happened where we were able to represent that global mindset that we learned in Japan, and other people were giving us the global mindset they learned in, you know, South America and so on and so forth. And I think the really interesting thing about those overlaps in the language courses is you're not even just learning from your other students about, you know, the student who worked in France teaching you about what their experience was like in France. You're also learning, like, I interacted with so many people in IPD, in the policy development, people in the education management course. So there was really just that small, tight-knit community of people who, while they didn't share the same language background or cultural background, had that background of global mindset, understanding, you know, how we can build those connections and translating that, like you were saying, that soft skills translation of this can apply to so many different fields and how do we better each other?
That's a really great point, because I think coming off of JET, I really didn't have, at least at that time, any perspective on what I had been a part of. I knew what had happened to me and everything, but like, I don't think I even realized that the JET program was modeled on Peace Corps and that there were other things out there, you know, trying to accomplish similar goals or in similar ways. And that would have been a really terrific way to re-enter my life in the US again, to be able to meet and connect with all these people. And I think I was longing for that in all my years in law, where I was not getting that at all. Which is why I eventually went back to ESL teaching and was able to do things with that. But yeah, it's an instant community of people that you can relate to, even if they haven't lived in Japan necessarily.
Exactly.
And what's the campus like there? I mean, do you go to the football games and root for Miss? I don't think they have
a football
team. It's
a bunch of language nerds. It would be so funny to see us all try to play football.
But is there a campus that people hang out on the campus and live on or close to campus? I know Monterey is a beautiful, I've never been there, but I remember seeing the shots of all the whales and orcas and sharks all gathering because of that's where the feeding was. And it just must be such a remarkable place to live.
If you listen closely, you can actually hear the sea lions barking while you're on campus.
Oh, from where I lived, you didn't have to listen closely.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, it's, you know, it's interesting because Monterey is such a small but quaint port town, little oceanside town. And the campus, you can walk onto it without really realizing you're there until you see the signs that say like, oh, this is so-and-so building for so-and-so studies. It really kind of has integrated into the downtown area and taking over, smaller houses along the way that are these really cute, basically become these cute little classrooms, which for me, a person who went to school in the middle of nowhere, Ohio, and also had a campus that was very much like, let's just take this house and convert it into a cute little educational space. It felt like home, but with the ocean.
And Scott, you're now teaching there. What's the experience like teaching, and how much do you teach in person, and do you teach online at all?
So we, in our program, we're doing a hybrid. So we offer the opportunity to attend remotely and attend in person. So last year it was maybe a little bit like 60% were away. And this year it's about 40 to 30% are remote. So I don't know what that'll be like in the future, but probably I imagine we'll keep that option because people can connect from different places and it's more convenient for them. So yeah, that's what we're doing. So I guess the first year of lockdown was all remote, and then we did introduce hybrid last year, and we're continuing with hybrid, and more people are coming, but it is expensive in Monterey and people have difficulty traveling and all that. So I believe we'll keep this option open. I think it's the best for everyone.
And what courses have you been teaching?
So I'm teaching program monitoring and evaluation. I'm teaching research methods and program design classes. I have a JET alumni in my class now, actually. And he's sitting right next to a guy that was in the Peace Corps. He was in Senegal, so I hear them talking about their experiences. It's really great.
And the JET alums all get better grades, right?
Of course.
It's not just the scholarship. It's also the... So Scott, how did you end up becoming a professor at MIS?
Well, one of my professors, like my mentor, let me put it that way. She taught me in my very first semester, and I took classes with her. I took at least three classes with her. So I wound up working with her after. She had a position in a nonprofit, and like, she gave me an internship, and then from the internship, I got a position. So she worked at MIS until just 2 years ago. So I've just always been in touch with her. We worked, in this nonprofit. And then when I earned my PhD, then I was started to think about teaching. And she pulled me in and said, hey, it'd be great if you did a class or two. And so I started to do some adjunct work, and I just really liked it. And just kind of, again, it connected to what I love so much about what I did at JET, was just standing in front of people and talking with them and kind of leading this group through new learning, just that energy that comes from when you collectively discover something together, and for me, I really like that connection that we can make. So this was the way to do it. So I taught then and I'm teaching now. So.
And Rebecca, do you ever think about teaching localization?
So hilariously enough, when I graduated, because, the localization program, it prepares people for many different languages in many different aspects of the translation industry. So at the time, I was kind of one of a few students really chasing how localization was working with game localization in particular, just because that was my niche. And we had a single game localization class that is still going on today. And the professor jokingly said to me at graduation, he's like, so you're going into game localization and in 5 years, we're going to see you back here teaching it. And I, at the time, was like, no. But every so often I think about it. I'm like, I definitely need more years in this. But there is a part of me that misses, just like what Scott was saying. I miss that teaching, being in front of a class, engaging them, seeing them grow into it and take those passions somewhere, wherever it leads them. So we'll have to see.
And in your work with Riot Games, what kind of work are you doing? I know you. I was looking at your profile online, and you had a line about so seamless that you don't even know it's there, or something. I'm sure I'm butchering it, but
probably saying it nicer than me. It's so what our department is trying to accomplish, and this was something that really started when I was on JET, because I played a lot of games, and I, being that fan of Japan, I played a lot of Japanese games, and there was always that kind of idea of the games I was interested in were coming out of Japan and I was playing them, but because I was someone who knew Japanese culture and stuff at least a little bit, I knew some things probably wouldn't make sense to your average player, but I knew Japanese culture. So I was one of the special ones who could get this game, understand what it was putting forward. But when I went back, or when I was teaching in Japan, I was teaching middle school. They love games as well. So I connected with them. And for the first time, I was really seeing that experience on the flip side, where they were playing games that originated in English and were being brought to them in Japanese. And I was getting these, hearing them talk about, this game really resonated with me. This one, the translation was kind of awkward. It was a little bit weird. It didn't really feel like it was made for me. And so my department now, what we focus on, and that tagline that you mentioned, is the idea that if translation is translating the words, localization is translating everything around it to make sure it feels like a seamless experience for all of our players in all of our regions. So a player playing in Korean should feel that the game was made for them just as much as a player playing in Brazilian Portuguese.
I always, I played a lot of video games growing up, although I never got into the, I think I was before the video games really took off. But, and I've worried about my own kids playing video games, but then I remind myself, it's also job training. It's not just wasting time. I know.
Absolutely.
That thought keeps intriguing me. Scott, were you a video game person at all?
No, not really. I had an Atari when I was a kid, but that's about as far as it went. I used to play Galaga at the corner shop there, 25 cents.
Yep.
Well, and it's funny to look at the experiences there, because really, when those games made it stateside, but there really wasn't that heavily concerted of an effort to translate it in a good way. So that was like the golden era of all your besar belong to us and a winner is you and all these translations that were just, they probably, some poor guy at the company who knew a little bit of English was told to, translate to the best of their ability. Whereas now it's a huge industry with so many different players .
And then there's localization. I know Disney movies now, there's been some media coverage about that, how Disney movies are instantly localized. And I just saw...
One of my favorite examples of that is, it's in the movie Inside Out. There's a scene where the baby is, they're trying to get her to eat broccoli in the original version made in America, and they changed it to green peppers, kimon, for Japan. Because broccoli doesn't have that negative connotation in Japan as much as green peppers do. So they knew, and that's a perfect example of this, where...
That's a great example.
Yeah, if they're watching the movie with broccoli, they don't, they're thinking, oh, it's just a fussy baby, I guess. Whereas with Pimon, it really resonates. Oh yeah, that's, we don't want to touch that.
That's a really good example.
Yeah. I've heard that used when they want to describe someone as being an airhead, they call them a Pima. Did you hear that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, because of, a pepper plant, kind of airy inside. It has not much.
Hollow.
Yeah, hollow.
but don't you, is there any effort to try to create some of those all your bases are belong to us? Just because wouldn't it be great? Have we lost the ability to have those now? Has something been lost? But that's a bigger question.
Oh, fans will find any way to pick apart a translation. It's almost, at this point, it's kind of grown into a new beast, where because people have so much access and you can see the translations that were done in all the different languages, we get a lot of people who say, well, I could have translated that better. Which
was
is
that
very
funny. Case study, Becca? How did you find out about that?
Oh, so actually, interestingly enough, one of my favorite courses at MIS, for the translation and localization management department, though it's open to anyone, I hope it's still being taught, was a class called, Design and Culture. It's something along those lines. Oh, the professor's gonna be so mad at me. But it was a fantastic, fun course where the whole focus was on, it's designing for internationalization and culture. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea is, you know, we all exist in our individual markets, in our individual cultural bubbles. So there are so many things that can fly under our radar that a lot of companies, when you're advising them, maybe don't think about. So it was this course to kind of prepare you to think globally. And we ended up having this fantastic final project where the whole point was to give some sort of like business presentation to trick everyone else in the room into thinking that it's okay when in your target market, it would be like absolutely unheard of. So there were examples of like people in, people trying to market potted plants, like get well present potted plants in Japan, which is just a huge no-go, I learned culturally, because in Japanese hospitals, if you give someone a potted plant, there's a superstition that it's like rooting them to the hospital. Mm. And examples like there's the famous example of the Nissan Pajero or Pajero in Japanese, Pajero, which was modeled after like, it's a sleek jungle cat, but in Spanish, it's definitely not a safe for work term. And that went to market, at least in Japan.
Oh, wow.
But globally, thankfully, they caught that one before it went live. But that was one of my favorite courses at MIS, because it really forced you to get outside your own bubble and learn from everyone else and just be so aware as we're, and I use it all the time, we make assumptions about what we can ship in a game, but unless we're consulting with all of our regional teams, we might put something out there that's extremely offensive.
Yeah, you don't know what you don't know.
Don't know what you don't know. And it is, you got to be humble and be willing to reach out to the people who do.
Well, I really want to thank both of you for joining me today. This has been a really eye-opening discussion for me and extremely helpful, because I've been aware of MIS and sort of knows what it's about, but you really put a lot more meat on the bones and made it more concrete for me, and I'm sure for many other Jet alums and future Jets out there. I want to finish by asking each of you, do either of you have any advice for Jets or Jet alums who might be thinking about the MIS programs, or have you ever been given any advice that was particularly helpful for you in thinking about your career in this way?
Speak to that a bit.
Yeah.
For me, I did not see myself as someone who would go to graduate school. And I don't want to use this opportunity as a pressure point to tell every Jet, go to graduate school, keep your education going in this degree. But what I found through MIS was it opened so many doors for me and my own education. It helped me solidify what I wanted to do with that experience post JET program. And not only that, it has such a large network that even if you're just thinking about it right now, I would encourage students to look at the various programs, reach out. There are so many people who overlap with both JET and MIS. And if I know anything about former Jets, it's that we love talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So there are many opportunities to reach out to former Jets, former MIS alum, just to get a feel for if you think this is something you could do, what they're doing with it. And I can just say very quickly that my current position I have because there was someone on the team who was not only a JET alum, but also a MIS alum. And we connected, she vouched for me, and I am so grateful to have had that connection. So reach out.
Mm-hmm. Nice perspective. I think the JET experience was about exchange and understanding and connection. And that's exactly what you'll get in this as well. It's a small community. There's small student teacher ratio. There's the students are tight with each other. There's a lot of exchanging and understanding. And we basically foster the skills for you to go out there and be an effective professional. And in my particular degree programs, it's about social change and human development. So, you know, we give you those skills, and it's a community that stays in touch and has a really strong alumni programming. So we definitely connect you with, you know, in your experience, we transition you from school to the professional world to a lot of different immersive learning experiences. And then and you get feedback from alumni who you know, graduated and then had some success in the world, and they can share their tips. So it's tight like that too, you know, intergenerationally, we bring people back. So you spend a little time to get your degree, but we stay with you for the rest of your life, basically, because we, those skills are enduring and the connections are enduring. So
100%.
Well, thank you so much. And for our listeners, we'll include LinkedIn profiles for both Becca and for Scott in the show notes in case you want to connect with them on LinkedIn or get in touch with them. So thanks again for joining me. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you again in the Jetosphere.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Becca.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jetosphere podcast, a production of JetWit.com. Special thanks to USJetAA and Claire for their support.